Campaigning for the Republican primary nomination in 2016, Donald Trump expressed his confidence with bold words.
I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Trump never put that one to the test, but time and again, as a candidate and as president, he said and did the kinds of unorthodox things that might have obliterated other people's political careers, up to and including expressing approval of the January 6th siege on the Capitol. What made it possible for him to depart so radically from traditional political norms and traditional Republican Party values without losing the backing of that party? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. While even the former president might not have been able to foresee just how much he would change the GOP and arguably American politics as a whole, he did start laying the groundwork early for a world in which his perspective could not be ignored, even when his grievances were based on false claims. The new Frontline documentary, Lies, Politics, and Democracy, lays out this story. Journalist Michael Kirk is the filmmaker behind it, and he joins us now to talk about the episode, which airs on PBS stations nationwide this week. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
You start this film with the reminder that there had been a long tradition in this country, even after the most acrimonious campaigns, of second-place finishers publicly conceding victory to their opponent. What I'm not sure we fully understood, Michael, was that this tradition is more than just a courtesy. It actually does help us accept election outcomes even when we don't like the result.
I think that's the theory, and like so many things that we reveal, I think, in the film, it's a norm that hadn't been broken until Donald Trump told what a lot of people call the big lie on the night of his of the presidential election in 2020. It's such a firm tradition that even all the way until the inauguration of a new president, you'll always hear a network anchor or someone say, and here it is once again, the thing that makes America unique, the nonviolent, peaceful passing of power from one party, from one president to a new president. That tradition was broken. That strain was broken by Donald Trump.
The aftermath of the 2020 elections was so shocking that, to be honest, I had forgotten that Donald Trump claimed he was cheated when Ted Cruz won GOP's Iowa primary in 2016. What kind of pattern did he have of crying foul play before he actually entered into electoral politics himself?
It really surprised me when we were doing the research. That's why we start the film with Ted Cruz's victory and then Donald Trump claiming that it was stolen and that Ted Cruz had cheated. A complaint that Donald Trump made, and the closer we look, the more often we saw a similar behavior by the former president when his program, his reality program, The Apprentice, lost I think it was the great race in the Emmy Awards. He claimed the Emmys were rigged and that he had been cheated out of that victory. And when Mitt Romney lost, Trump, who supported Romney, started a tweet campaign that essentially said the election had been rigged and stolen from Mitt Romney. And frighteningly, he laid out the kind of plan of all the things that he would say at the end of the election evening in 2020.
It's funny that some of this feels like ancient history, but Mr. Trump had detractors in his own party all throughout the 2016 primary race. I guess people in the GOP leadership felt it would be risky to alienate Trump's base based on their assumption that they would need to convert those voters to supporting another Republican who surely they thought would win the party's nomination.
It's a very funny and complicated equation that happens with the people who either called themselves Never Trumpers or people who were actually in the leadership of the GOP at the time that Trump was rising and knocking off one by one all of the party leaders, 16 I think, was the final count of how many people he vanquished leading up to the final one standing, which was Ted Cruz. And then he and Cruz had their battle, one of the ugliest, I think probably the ugliest primary campaign in history. It is interesting what the GOP establishment thought and did and really didn't do watching it go by, I think because they were making the calculation at the time, people like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and others, Lindsey Graham, who believed that Trump was just a laughable character who would not ever actually get the nomination, so they didn't need to worry about him.
It took a while for Ted Cruz to convert himself to supporting the Trump campaign, but what message did that conversion send to others in the GOP?
Well, when he was defeated by Trump, he of course got to be a speaker at the Republican convention, and really was torn about the idea of, do I endorse Trump? And in the end, he said he would not endorse Trump because, as he said, history does not look kindly on the person who holds Mussolini's jacket. He had been roundly criticized. His wife had been made fun of by Trump. His father had been connected to the JFK assassination by Trump. And yet, and then when he got on the stage, he was booed so vociferously. It was shocking at the time. It was shocking to see it as we were editing it into the film. They just booed him off the stage. And it was clear that a new Republican Party was in residence and they were supporting Donald Trump. And in Cruz's case, it was clear that what he had to do was make a decision. Was he going to be politically relevant and support a man who had been so mean to him? There's no other word for it. And people who had been so unhappy with him, did he want a political future or not? And this was a calculation so many politicians would make during the Trump administration. Cruz chose to swallow his pride and jump on the Trump bandwagon.
Is it fair to say most traditional Republican politicians never thought Trump could win until he won?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even after he won, they never thought he'd win the presidential election. They didn't think he'd win the primary. Then when he wins the primary, they're sort of going along. They are, by the way, shocked and amazed at the crowd that booed Ted Cruz off the stage. They were there, too. Mitch McConnell was there, too. Paul Ryan was there, too. And they were kind of saying the right things so that they could be viewed as good Republicans. But they figured Hillary Clinton, like most of America, at least in the polls, thought that Hillary Clinton would be elected. So they did, they thought so, too. Well, they thought, what's the harm? We'll just go along with this guy. And when they heard the MAGA crowd, the people that make America great crowd that was booing Cruz off the stage, I think it was a wake-up call for them. And they said to themselves and in their actions, this guy might win. And if he wins, what are we going to do about him? And that was a big calculation they all had to make. Do they fight? Do they cut him off at the pass? Do they stop him? Or do they manipulate him and try to take advantage of what they saw as a truly weak, ideology-free reality TV star who was about to become president? And certainly they didn't like him. Certainly they didn't understand him. They didn't share his ideology. So they thought to themselves, well, we'll go along with them and we'll have unified Republican government in Washington. We'll get rid of Obamacare. We'll do a lot of other stuff and he will sign the bills. And that was what they went into that first year, 2017, believing about Donald Trump. Of course, they were completely wrong. And by the end of that year, he had manipulated them and he was in charge of the Republican Party.
Regardless of what one thinks about Donald Trump, his selection of Mike Pence as a running mate was a pretty brilliant move.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mike Pence, who was in a lot of political trouble in Indiana, he was governor and he was going down fast, and his political career was on the ropes and definitely did not look like a shining moment ahead, that there was a shining moment ahead for Mike Pence. When he agrees to join the Trump ticket, bringing with him religious conservatives, other conservatives, people who knew Pence to be a representative of their view of what the Republican Party was, and Pence brought that kind of legitimacy that Trump desperately needed. He was not a favorite of conservatives, especially religious conservatives, thrice married, lots of outrageous publicity for affairs he had had in the news. And Mike Pence was his shield, his free pass, his whatever you want to call it, with the religious right conservatives, who were a very important part of the Republican constituency. And for Pence's part, he did what politicians said. He also thought, I think, that Hillary Clinton was going to win. But from his perspective, knowing that his career was in real trouble in Indiana, there's nothing wrong with being on television 500 or 600 times during the summer and the early fall as a vice presidential candidate of a candidate like Donald Trump, who would surely lose in the general election. But it would give Pence another step up and a potential a run for president in 2024.
The film reveals the fact that a lot of high-ranking Republicans with more traditional agendas than President Trump would have actually assumed in the beginning that if he did happen to win, which they thought was a long shot, they could manipulate him into doing the party's bidding. They could sort of convert him to being a more traditional Republican.
Yes, and he did what they didn't think he could possibly do, which was not play the game the way they wanted to play it. He was argumentative. He was demanding. He had a base that scared the heck out of them. That people that had not been Republicans before. A lot of young white males who had listened to Alex Jones and other right-wing radio to get their political education. They were coming to the Republican Party, courted by Trump and Roger Stone and others, specifically because they were new and fresh and angry, legitimately in many cases, about what was going on in America from their perspective. So there they were, this powerful force that he could call upon at any moment. And I think they were new and they were vocal and they could rise up. And I think the Republican establishment looked the other way and then allowed Trump to, in lots of ways, manipulate them so that they were beholden to him instead of the other way around.
Is there, do you think, a certain amount of psychology, you know, when these leaders who maybe privately disagreed with Trump or had different perspectives than him started saying things the way he said them, do you think there's some kind of psychological effect that happens when you say this stuff enough in public, you have to start to believe it?
This is what Bill Kristol, you know, an American, kind of very well-known American conservative whose father was the Irving Kristol who'd gotten the neoconservative movement in America going. Bill ran the American Standard and really represented a sort of very conservative strain in American politics. And he said to us, it was all about slowly boiling the frog for them. And that's what happened to the Republican leadership.
Michael, Donald Trump's sense was that anybody who supported him was a good and worthy ally, up to and including people like the white supremacists in Charlottesville. This was a line Paul Ryan didn't want to cross, but you note in the film his disavowal of that bigotry did not mention Trump by name. Ryan thought that was too risky politically?
They were afraid of him. They were afraid of him. And he was so, we interviewed one of the people who's the top advisor to Ryan, who said, you know, you push back as hard as you can on somebody like Trump, who doesn't know anything about separation of power. He doesn't know anything about even the legislation that he's fighting for or against. Isn't really curious about how any of that works. The White House itself was in total chaos a lot of the time. And Ryan would push back, but he said it got to the point where you can't push back every day. And Trump was so vociferous, so angry, so in attack mode, that they finally just gave up attacking him. And as we know, Ryan didn't want to be the Speaker of the House anymore, and didn't want to be in the United States Congress, and neither did a lot of other people, who Republicans who tried to step up and say, wait a minute, this is all crazy, especially after what was clearly racist comments from the President of the United States at about Charlottesville, when he said Nazis and others are very fine people. Very, very, very hard for an awful lot of Republicans to handle. But they couldn't. They wrote their emails. They wrote their tweets. They pushed back the way they could. But nobody in Republican leadership, not McConnell, not Ryan, certainly not Kevin McCarthy, not Lindsey Graham, nobody mentioned the president in their attacks. And that's because they were afraid.
Paul, Ryan wanted out. We know what happened to Mark Sanford now and Jeff Flake. More than three dozen Republicans in Congress did not run for re-election in 2018. Who filled that vacuum within the GOP?
This new group of very pro-Trump supporters, and generally speaking, people much more ideological even than the president. We'd already experienced, in '94 the Gingrich revolution, then Sarah Palin, then the rise of Trump, the Tea Party, the Freedom Caucus. So there was already a kind of strain of many, many Republicans growing out of American anger at economic displacement and other things that were happening, appropriate anger in lots of cases, and people who, but people who came in were not, they were not about government in the classic case. They were not politicians in the sense that they understood how the process worked. They believed in the norms of the party. They believed in bipartisanship on some issues. So there was a kind of a whole new group of people, very, very, very partisan. And of course, Trump could use and manipulate them as well. And Washington became what Washington became, and the anger quotient rose in that place and around the country around the issues that Trump was pushing.
It was a sort of badly kept secret that Mitch McConnell did not care personally for Donald Trump. What kind of deal did he work out with him so that McConnell would publicly pledge his loyalty to the president, even if in private it was pretty clear there was no love lost between the two?
There are people in our film who we talk to, sort of political science experts and others, especially people who worry a lot about and study a lot about how authoritarianism rises in a democracy. And they watched this kind of thing start to grow when a politician like McConnell, who does not like the president of the United States, basically, as you say, Chris, the word around Washington was he loathed Donald Trump personally, and was frustrated beyond belief that Trump was so inadequate as a president in political terms. But he knew Trump was the president, and he had things he wanted, and he wanted judges for the Supreme Court. He wanted very conservative judges to dominate the court and keep the court right of center for at least a generation. And he wanted a big tax cut. And so did other Republicans. So McConnell went to the White House one day and said, look, let's let bygones be bygones, and let's cut a deal. We need you to help us do this. Get the judges for the Supreme Court, and we'd like a great big fat tax cut. And Trump said, okay, I'm with you on that. I'll do those things. You'll help me do those things. Tell me what you need. And in other words, furnish me with judges and names. I don't know anybody. And what he asked from McConnell is something that really means a lot to Donald Trump. And that's, he said, what I want in return is loyalty. I want your loyalty. And he would expect that, and he would receive that all the way through the second impeachment after the January 6th incursion into the Capitol building. That was the deal McConnell cut. Now, back to the experts who study authoritarianism and who say moments like this, Mike Pence, Mitch McConnell, throwing their weight behind somebody who doesn't really deserve it and doesn't really even agree with them, and they don't agree with him, but to give that weight, thinking that what you're doing is manipulating him, thinking that what you're doing is that you've got the upper hand. The fact is, you do not. The authoritarian will use you to rationalize and your pledge of loyalty to justify his next steps and his next steps and his next steps. And that's what our film, I think, demonstrates, is how that alliance led, of course, first to January 6th incursion and beyond.
We have Patrick on the line in Salt Lake City. Hi, Patrick. Hey, Patrick, are you with us? All right. I think Patrick had some questions about whether it's possible, Michael, that President Trump or his, you know, sort of op research people had dirt on other politicians and therefore was able to get their backing by making sure they knew that he could ruin them publicly.
Well, he wouldn't be the first president that tried to do that. And it's very possible that that's true. But the thing that really got everybody to line up, even in the face of the January 6th incursion, where 197 Republicans in the House still support the idea that the election was stolen, even though, as we have people in the film who say, even though they knew, one person said, 99% of them freely admitted they didn't believe that the election had been stolen, but they were, you know, in a death fight with the Democrats, and they wanted to win. But there was another reason, which people told us, which is that many people who voted, especially in relation to the second impeachment, were afraid of physical harm from the very people and the groups that had attacked the Capitol building. They said things out loud like, if they could get in the Capitol building and almost get to me, what's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to my children, my wife, when I'm not there? They were terrified. And I think that is happening. And is one of the justifications for the votes many of these otherwise fine people seem to be taking. That's at least what the people we interviewed were telling us. There is a kind of fear factor there that's driving a lot of the decisions around the post January 6th moment.
It's fascinating to me that Liz Cheney has come to be seen as this kind of perfidious defector from Republican values and agendas. I mean, she was instrumental in keeping fellow Republicans from voting to convict in Trump's first impeachment trial, wasn't she?
Liz Cheney is a rock-ribbed, solid conservative Republican. In all my years of covering Washington, I know and have reported on her father, and I watched her follow in the family business and be really known as a seriously classic Republican, hard-nosed conservative. She was 100% against the first Democratic impeachment against Trump. She was the defender. She was number three in the Republican House caucus. And she held those people in place. None of them voted for that impeachment. And that was Liz Cheney as in a leadership role. But when it came time for the Stop the Steal Republicans to step up, the people I've been talking about who were intimidated or knew to the Congress, people who Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House or leader of the Republicans, was managing. Cheney tried to say, no, that's a step too far, you guys. We can't do this. This is not what Republicans do. This is again, the guy was elected. Biden was elected president. Let's admit that this is a lie, and now it's a series of justifications to get away with a lie, which is a constitutional crisis of the first magnitude. And what did they do? They threw her out of leadership, and they worked very hard to make sure that she wasn't reelected in Wyoming, of all places, where the Cheney family is like the political family, and the way the Bushes used to be the political family, and they just got rid of her, and it's a fascinating example of what has gone on inside the Republican Party when even what we used to call hard right Republican conservative like Liz Cheney is not on the president's team, on the supporting the lie that the election was stolen. She is thrown out. That's an amazing moment, I think, that a lot of people we interviewed, and we only interviewed Republicans in this film. There are reporters and there are journalists, but there's the political people we interviewed were Republicans, and there were many of them who were shocked and amazed at what had happened to Liz Cheney.
Michael, how did then-President Trump use the unrest around George Floyd's murder as an opportunity to project his own particular flavor of power?
One of the things the experts we talked to in the film about the rise of authoritarianism in America, especially during the Trump presidency, was this idea that he was the strong man. Many authoritarians will project strength. They form alliances with the military and the police forces, and they tell people in their country that they're under threat from some enemy. And Trump's feelings and problems with race, going all the way back to Charlottesville, and of course before he was president, many people we talked to, including people in the Republican Party, just assume he is a racist, and this issue, the race issue, emerged during the murder of George Floyd by the police officers in Minneapolis, what Trump's response was to claim that we needed police presence. Antifa and other groups were taking over the cities, were burning down the cities. And it was that day when he walked across Lafayette Park, right across the street from the White House, where he had all those protesters cleared, that a lot of the authoritarian watchers said was an inflection point. And the fact that the Republican Party supported that, didn't go against that, didn't stand up and say, wait a minute, Mr. President, you've gone too far, turning the streets of Washington right across from the White House into some place that a lot of people said to us in the film looks like a third world country. All of a sudden, here was Donald Trump performing the function that he had promised during his convention, that he would be the strong man. And here it was on full display, another example to the people who watch for authoritarianism of a very dangerous turn that had taken in the society. And a lot of the people who were supporting that moment became the people and were on the streets in other cities fomenting civil disobedience against the Black Lives Matter protesters were the people who would eventually attack the Capitol building.
Michael, Donald Trump would not be the first president to be upset about being a one-term president. We heard stories years ago about George H.W. Bush feeling quite depressed when he lost to Bill Clinton. But I'm not sure I knew this before your film. After the 2020 elections, Trump did not leave the White House residence for days, like did not come down out of the residence, even into the Oval Office. Is it fair to say this indicates he understood he had lost?
I don't know how to read that, Chris. We've talked to people who say, we talked to one woman in the film who was his communications director, who said, you know, she was having a conversation with him in the Oval Office a few days after the election, and he sort of said, "Can you believe I lost to this blank?" Talking about Biden. Does that indicate he knew that he'd lost, and that he was just formulating a master plan that would be consistent with his complaint about The Apprentice not winning an Emmy, or Ted Cruz having cheated him out of the Iowa caucus victory, and Mitt Romney losing to Obama? Was this just the pattern would be reestablished again? Certainly that is all true, and that would happen. But he'd been talking a lot before the election, almost like he was hedging his bet that he was, well, if I lost, he would never agree that he was going to verify or let Biden be president. He used to say that all the time. I'm not going to do that. I think elections can be rigged. I don't believe that. So was he despondent, or was he formulating? Was he planning this? What as I say, a lot of people called the big lie, the stop the steal movement, whatever you want to call whatever he believed he could get rolling. Certainly it's true that within a couple of weeks, everything was going full blast, and it was the silence of established Republicans who didn't just come right out and say that night and the next day and the next day and say, "Come on, Mr. President, you know and we know, no, Joe Biden is the president. Let's be grand about this. Let's be gracious about this. And let's move on and lick our wounds and come back and get him in the midterms and get him in 2024. But they didn't do that. They were, all the Republican leaders in the establishment were very, very quiet about this. And it gave Trump and the people around Trump, not his legal staff, but outside lawyers like Rudy Giuliani and others, to come in and really formulate this plan, this plot to get people to believe out there, the true believers in Trump, to believe this big lie that the election had been stolen.
So you've helped us understand how it is that mainstream Republicans maybe held their noses and worked with Trump and supported him publicly because they wanted judges, they wanted a tax cut, they wanted certain things done that would happen more easily if they had the support of the president in their party. That said, it would also seem as if, you know, Trump's defeat to Joe Biden in 2020 would give them the perfect excuse to move on and reformulate the party as they had been operating it before he came along. Why did Mitch McConnell not only not immediately say that Trump had lost the election, but tell his colleagues not to say anything at all about the results?
I think they were afraid of setting him off. I think they were afraid of what he might do. I'm not even trying to read minds. I mean, I'm a reporter. I only know what I know from other people. So I'm now reporting what I think, as I have been in this whole conversation, what other people have told me. And a lot of people said they were just hoping he would go away quietly. They were very afraid, as they had been all through his presidency, of his ability to tap into the MAGA angry extremist base. And they weren't sure what the implications of that would be. I think they were very worried about violence in America. Civil war is sort of overstating it, I think, but maybe not after a while. But I think they were worried about what he would do and what the irrational acts he would employ. They didn't know exactly what he would do and what he would say. And I think they thought, the guy will go away. And little did they know what was actually happening out there in America. And when, of course, we report, he doesn't go to the inauguration. He gets on Air Force One for the last time. It takes off and he calls Rona McDaniel. This is a disputed story, but a very, very, very highly sourced. So just for anybody listening, this apparently really happened. He calls Ronald McDaniel, the head of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, and says, I'm out. I'm going to form my own party. I'm taking these people with me. And she sent the message, believe me, instantly to all of the leadership of the Republican Party. This is our worst nightmare. Donald Trump leaves and takes with him the very reason we have won, the very reason we are in the kind of power we're in, which is the votes of this new fringe Republican group. And if he pulls them out, maybe he pulls Fox News with him, and that's it for the Republican Party. And I think in the face of that, the Republican leadership decided we've got to pull him back. We've got to support him. And we're sorry we didn't speak out sooner, but now we've got to go along with it, and we've got to act like we believe it.
What were you able to learn about Donald Trump and his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, about their knowledge of or involvement in planning for what would happen after Trump addressed that crowd in the Ellipse on January 6th?
Well, I mean, we don't know nearly as much as, for example, the January 6th committee knows, because we don't have the ability to subpoena and make people swear to the truth. But what we know is that there were very real plans inside the White House to hold on to power any way they could, and to throw away those votes, get new votes. They for a while they worked Mike Pence over. They almost got Pence to go. If Pence would have agreed not to go into the Congress and not validate, I don't know how he would have done that. He has no constitutional authority or any legal authority whatsoever. But let's say he did it and it threw the room into some kind of chaos. We interviewed Judge Michael Luttig, who's a constitutional lawyer and a very conservative judge, a Republican judge, who said America, where there would have not been a president inaugurated on the 20th of January, and America would have been in the worst crisis since the Civil War.
What did it take for Mike Pence to ultimately refuse to do Trump's bidding on January 6th?
He had swallowed so much bad stuff in 3+ years of standing next to, behind, and near Donald Trump doing his bidding all over America. Things that, and when watching the way Trump acted, things that, I'm sure Trump hadn't signed on for, but was loyal and a good loyal Republican in that sense. And now he was being asked to do something that he just knew if he did it, it would be wrong. And he has that kind of moral streak about him, they tell us. And he went looking for a justification. And when they found Judge Luttig, who was willing to say the Constitution, you have no constitutional authority to do this. This is not something that the vice president can do or should do, and you shouldn't do it. He learned that the morning of January 6th, when he was going to have to go up to the Congress and perform his duties, which were essentially symbolic. Stand there, bang the gavel, say, that's that, and the election is over, and congratulations, Joe Biden. And I think what he did not know when he said that he was not going to, we told Trump he was not going to do it. What he did not know was that he was putting his life on the line, and that the supporters, the extremists, the people who attacked the Capitol building and really defiled it and democracy in a symbolic sense, those people were yelling, hang Mike Pence, when he didn't do what Donald Trump had sort of out of the blue and the people around Trump had invented as a course for keeping the presidency. I think Pence came as close as it is possible to coming as a vice president to being killed. Shocking and amazing. And I think for him must have been a real moment of wondering what he'd been part of for all those years.
Michael, House Leader Kevin McCarthy called Trump on January 6th in the middle of the chaos and essentially asked him to call off the dogs. Eventually, Trump did that after quite a delay. But what was his response on the phone to McCarthy?
Kevin, I think it's amazing that you're calling up. They had a shouting match that was apparently unparalleled, profane and very intense. And Trump yelled back at him that he was disappointed that the people who were up there, that Kevin was not in favor of the people who were up there trying to make sure that Trump's election was not stolen, saying that McCarthy, who'd stuck with him, Trump used to call him my Kevin, that the speaker or the hopeful speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, would do almost anything for Donald Trump. But when he saw what was happening there, he called and he told the president to call them off. And Trump said, I can't believe, Kevin, that these people obviously care more about what's happened to me in the presidency than you do. A shocking moment for McCarthy. And when we heard it and others have heard it, they were just equally stunned that here these two were, who'd been such, been so close. And McCarthy had done what a lot of people consider to be the right thing. Finally, after it's all off, after January 6th was over, he, Lindsey Graham, McConnell, all stepped up and walked away from the president and said it was the president's fault. So finally, people said, finally, this is it. The Republicans have come to their senses, and Donald Trump will go away and he won't be able to harm them.
Are Republicans trying behind the scenes to find candidates who would be strong enough to pose a real challenge in the event Trump decides to run again in 2024?
If they are, they better be doing it quietly. I mean, I'm assuming Ron DeSantis, the governor of Texas, Florida, although I suppose Governor Abbott could also be on the short list. I think there are movements by individuals and groups around individuals. There always are, and there probably should be. But I think until Trump makes a decision about, you know, whether he is or whether he is not in, anybody who's thinking of challenging him has to be very careful. And of course, everybody's watching to see whether his anointed candidates for in the midterms win around the country, and how much juice is actually in Trump's endorsement. Is it really something that can get you elected in battleground areas? And if it is, they'll all fade into the background and Trump will emerge again.
If you had to wager $5, would you wager that Trump will throw his hat in the ring, or that he will find some reason to avoid running again for fear of another, what must have been an embarrassing defeat?
Well, if he doesn't really believe that he was defeated, it's hard to be embarrassed by it. He's a fighter. He does completely unpredictable things. He has a very voracious need for money. A presidential campaign is a great place to raise a lot of money and have a lot of money. And he, Donald Trump, desperately, they tell me, needs money. Ironically. So I would bet on Trump running.
Journalist Michael Kirk is a filmmaker for PBS Frontline. His newest documentary is titled Lies, Politics, and Democracy and airs Tuesday night around the country on PBS. Michael, thanks as always for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks very much.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram. Just search for KERA Think or check us out on the website think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.